This is the Medicast, September 22nd, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast. This is episode 136, and I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic. I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week and certainly encourage you to head over and check out the Medicast site where you'll find links to everything we talk about in this episode. All of those show notes are available over there under the category podcasts. You'll find that as you scroll down on the left-hand side under the categories there. And that way you can follow up on anything you've learned about in this episode or any other episode of the Medicast, because I provide links back to the news stories and to other authoritative resources for the tips and the meds that we cover here. I want to welcome all of our brand new listeners and encourage you to continue listening to the show and get involved with the Medicast community here. You'll find all of the long-term listeners and contributors to the show available for you over at the Medicast forums at forums.medicast.com. And of course, you can always comment directly to me by sending me an email to podmedic@mac.com. I love to hear from the listeners. I love to keep in touch with you and know what's going on. It may take me a few days to get back to you. I get a lot of emails, but I really, really enjoy hearing your successes and your failures and your struggles and the links that you send me. I may not include that link in the show that week, but I certainly like to read about all of the EMS news stories that are important to you. So keep those links and emails coming in. You can also get in touch with us at the voicemail line at 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Time to look at the listener email that I've gotten in this week, and I want to thank everybody for sending in this email. I know I said it before, but you know, it really makes my progress in getting the show together each week a lot easier. It tells me what's important to you. I don't use every tip and item that comes in, but I try to file everything away, and certainly I appreciate it. Listener David and listener Doug both sent me links to news items this week that talked about EMS issues, and I just want to thank you both for sending me these links and keep that information coming in. It's really great to hear from both of you, and you guys have both been good supporters of the show, and I really appreciate that. So keep looking at the news items for me and keep those links coming in. I also got an email in from listener Rob. Rob has been a long supporter of the show, and you know I talk about GoDaddy.com periodically on the show as a sponsor of the show. Rob used his GoDaddy discount and went ahead and got himself some domain names and started using his own website, and he just wanted to let me know that he really had a good experience working with them. So I want to thank Rob for that. There'll be more information on how you can get some savings at GoDaddy over at the website in the show notes for this episode. But this is more about Rob's email. And Rob wanted to let me know that he has started a new site. It's called EMT Wannabe, EMTWANNABE.com. And it's some information for EMTB students, provides some links and resources, places like the Medicast, and it's still under construction, but he just wanted me to talk about it here on the show a little bit. So Rob, I want to thank you very much for doing that. Of course, anybody out there that has a website, you can link to the Medicast if you'd like a specific graphic or banner or button or badge that you'd like me to put together for your site. Just give me the dimensions that you want and I'll go ahead and put something together for you, and you can just cut and paste the code in and it will give you an opportunity to add something attractive to your site. I also don't mind if you use the Medicast player on your site. You know, that little player button that you click and it pops open a window and begins playing the most recent episode of the show. If you'd like to add something like that to your site, you can certainly do so. I can provide you the code to implant that at your site as well. It's a great way to provide additional resources for your site visitors without letting them get away from your site. They'll pop open this banner. It will actually start its own player, and they can continue surfing your website while they listen to the Medicast. So, Rob, thanks for your comments, and I thank you for using GoDaddy, and I'm glad you're happy with their services. I'm looking forward to seeing more from your site in the future. I also got an email in from listener Flo. I'm assuming Flo is a girl, but it may not be. Flo, if you're not a woman, I know that you have a website overseas, and that may Flo is short for Florian, maybe a man's name. If it is, you can get back to me, and I will give you great apologies next week on the show. But you checked in and wanted to know about domestic violence research on ambulance units, domestic violence on how we handle that, and wanted to know if I'd done anything in my show about it. And you know, Flo, I haven't, but I know that there may have been some other resources out there. I'm going to keep looking for them so that I can get them back to you. But you can also let me send this out to the rest of the listeners. So for all of you listening to the show, if you have access to some information on dealing with domestic violence as an EMS responder, if you have looked at a study, taken a class, maybe found an article about it, you want to send that link back here to me or that information back here to me at podmedic@mac.com, and I can forward that on to Flo. Flo's been a longtime supporter of the show. Links back to Medicast from the website that she runs, and it's a great opportunity for you to give back to somebody who's been supporting the Medicast. So anybody out there know anything about domestic violence response for EMS, we'll get that information gathered here and forward it on. And I'll also talk about it here on the show. It's a great topic for us to add to future topics here on the Medicast. Flo, you might also want to try over at the Medicast forums at forums.medicast.com. It's a great way to ask directly to the listener community there as well. And thanks for supporting the show and keeping in touch. I got an email in finally here from Melody. Melody was listening to the show. We were talking about audio versions of EMS textbooks, and she just wanted to point out that the Brady textbooks actually have some audio support files available at VanGo Notes. And these are basically audio files from the authors of the textbook chapters where they talk about some key issues associated with the topics in that chapter. Now, it's not a straight reading of the chapter, but it's a discussion about the chapter. And it should be a good support thing for you to use when you're studying from the textbook. And this can be found at vangonotes.com, VanGoNotes.com. I believe there's a fee involved, but again, if you are using the Brady textbooks, you may either get a discount or be able to access those with a user code from inside the cover of your textbook. I'm not sure of that, but you can try that out and see. So, Melody, thank you very much for including that information and getting in touch with me here. And make sure you keep in touch with me here at the Medicast. I'm going to lead into the news right now. And I want to really, this is a bizarre story, so listen carefully. But it just outlines how we need to remember whose emergency we're responding to. If we are on the road and out there heading down the highway and we're running lights and sirens, it doesn't mean that we don't have to be prepared to stop on a dime. We need to remember that it's not our emergency. It's someone else's emergency. And when we get to the scene, if we aren't prepared to take care of the patient because we've caused an accident of our own or have injuries of our own to deal with, then we've just taken ourselves out of the picture. And now it's become our emergency, and we aren't there to help the public that we're supposed to be helping in the field. Now, this particular story is a story out of New Jersey, and an ambulance was responding to a motor vehicle accident that had killed 4 people this past week. And when the ambulance responded to the scene, it ran into a medevac helicopter on the ground being ready to transport a victim to an area hospital. Now, this was available for these victims in case they needed transport. Ultimately, they didn't get flown to the hospital because they were already dead at the scene. But this was a problem that we need to be aware of. You know, when you are approaching a scene or anywhere, you need to be wary of responders who have arrived at the scene before you, bystanders who have stopped to lend assistance. We have press vehicles. We have things like medevac choppers. We have a whole host of other things on the scene of an accident. We need to be very wary on how we approach accident scenes, and certainly don't need to be going so fast that we crash into a helicopter. Now, this is a big problem, but I guess you can check out the article for yourself. Clearly, something we need to be aware of and stay on top of, and remember to respond appropriately when we're out on the road. Next up, a look at a service in Canada that is now offering free CPR and defibrillator clinics for parts of their community. And I think this is a great program. This is from Kawartha Lakes EMS program, and they are working in partnership with the Heart and Stroke Foundation of Ontario, and they are going to be offering these clinics for people to learn CPR and learn how to use AEDs in their community. Now, these are public access defibrillation clinics, PAD clinics, and I think this is a great look at how we can have a very positive impact on the long-term survival rates of CPR in our community. These cardiac arrests that occur before we can get there, bystander CPR is one of the key principles that allows us to have good survival rates in cardiac arrest cases. If there is no bystander CPR, if there is no public access defibrillation nearby, that rate goes down significantly. So what we need to do is we need to improve people's chances to survive heart attack and stroke. And that comes from educating the public to recognize danger signs. Call 911 before the onset of cardiac arrest when you see signs of acute myocardial infarction, if you see signs of a stroke onset. These things can help us to get to the patient before they need things like CPR and defibrillation. And that's all part of the CPR class. So we need to get out there and take care of that. As this article points out, every minute that somebody is down in a cardiac arrest, their chance of survival drops off by 10%. 10 minutes, 0% chance. But when you add early CPR to the equation, you extend that early survival time. You extend the curve before it starts to slope downward. You give them a chance that increases by about 30% in the early minutes of cardiac arrest. And that's an important point. We can make a significant difference. You hate going do cardiac arrests. You hate getting out there and having to go through the motions, even though you know survival is unlikely. Well, improve survival rates. Teach your public CPR. Teach them to have access to and how to apply for public access defibrillation devices and have AEDs placed in key locations around your community, and you can improve your cardiac survival rates too. So kudos to Ontario, kudos to Kawartha EMS, and to the Ontario Stroke and Cardiac Arrest Association. All of these things are great examples of what we can do in all of our communities. Let's move from a look at some Canadian EMS concerns down to Australia. We have a lot of friends listening to the show down there, and I found an article looking at a story out of Queensland, and this particular article is about a person that was involved in a bicycling accident, and a local paramedic student was in the region and was actually sent directly to the scene to provide assistance until senior paramedics, trained paramedics, could arrive. Now, this was a student paramedic, and there were some concerns apparently voiced in the community on why this student was put in this position, but the student provided care prior to the arrival of an ambulance and two advanced care paramedics. This is something that is unusual, and gladly, it's nice to see the Queensland Ambulance Service Commissioner defending the actions of the dispatch center and this student. Now, this student wasn't completely alone on the scene. The student was able to work with physicians via radio to work together until qualified paramedics arrived, but it took them about 15 minutes to get to the scene after she had arrived. So clearly, care needed to be administered, and until that could be taken care of and dealt with, we needed a trained provider of any level on the scene to provide first responder care. It's nice to see that we're backing each other up, we're providing support when you have to make an unusual decision, and then, you know, learn from that. Find ways to talk about this in your classrooms. If you are an instructor talking to EMTBs or paramedic students, talk to them about what's appropriate as far as scene response in your region. Talk to them about why, you know, we're in an emergency service and this is a situation that is fluid. We're never going to approach a textbook situation. There's always going to be some variable that makes it unusual, that makes it different from what we might be expecting. This is a situation that will probably never happen again in Queensland, but they had the ability to think on their feet and make a decision and then handle it with some backup on the scene as quickly as possible and then standing behind the decisions that were made later on. It doesn't mean you don't sit there and say we're going to change the policy or make an adjustment, but you still back up the people that had to make a tough decision at that moment because no one else was there to make that call. Somebody had to make a decision, and that's something that will never change. The person on the scene is going to have to make snap judgments. Sometimes they're going to be the right call, and sometimes they're not. But you can't go around second-guessing all the time. I try very hard not to second-guess mistakes made in the field because I think that there but for the grace of God go I. If I've never made a mistake in the field, I wouldn't be sitting here right now because I'd be super paramedic. You know, the fact remains we all make mistakes and we learn from those mistakes and it makes us better providers. So I'm glad to see that there's backup involved here, that they're standing behind decision makers and that they're prepared, it looks like, to continue to stand behind decision makers in the field. For our final story, you know, we talk about a bad situation going from bad to worse, and sometimes we call it a train wreck. You know, that situation was a train wreck. Well, if you've never actually been on a train wreck, you might not want to start using that phrase all the time freely like so many of us do. And the reason for that is that when you actually get to a real train wreck, you probably develop a whole new respect for the meaning of that phrase. And I don't mean this as a humorous statement, but you know, so often we throw around terms like this and they mean so many different things. There's a great article over at emsresponder.com looking at the expectations of responders and how some of their expectations collided with what actually happened at the scene. And this is something that I've talked about before, preparing for the eventuality of a bad situation. Rick Rosati over at the Mitigation Journal talks about the rule of outcomes, how you can prepare for bad situations, major situations, by thinking about them ahead of time and applying the skills and knowledge you already hold to these bigger situations using skills like basic triage, basic initial assessment, and using that to apply that skill to a larger situation. In Los Angeles this past week, we had a train wreck, which was more than anyone could really expect. This was a situation where EMS responders, fire responders, and police responders arrived on the scene to find a situation where they had a train collision, a passenger train colliding with a freight train, and a lot of wreckage, a lot of devastation, and a lot of people that needed to be evaluated for injuries. This situation involved hundreds of responders from all areas, and it was a shock to even those that thought they knew what a train wreck would look like. This was a situation that had a death toll of 25 individuals. There are different reasons for why this happened. An off-duty sheriff's deputy who survived the crash, helped numerous victims get out of it despite his own broken collarbone. He developed a collapsed lung, had a puncture wound to his thigh, and still managed to get individuals out of the train before succumbing to his own injuries, still in critical and stable condition. So these rescue workers arrived on the scene where some of the patients weren't only general bystanders, the public they serve anyway, but also some of their own responders, some of their own friends and colleagues on these trains. It's really hard for these rescuers to deal with this situation, and I think the article at emsresponder.com does a great job of kind of painting the picture of what they developed and what they ran into. They had to cut through wreckage, cut through fencing, use different approach vectors to get to the scene from different sides as traffic began to back up. Additional ambulances were needed, additional rescue trucks and fire trucks were needed, as well as response crews from numerous other agencies. Really, this became a huge problem. And this is a great article that looks exactly at how they adjusted to dealing with this particular tragedy. I hope to see more articles about this particular topic in the future, and also to see what did they learn? What can we take away from this? All of us have some aspect of mass transportation somewhere in our region, whether it's planes, whether it's a train moving through our area, or whether it's just buses with charter buses with people from local organizations going on trips and local highways with those vehicles traveling. All of these can present serious complications when they are full and involved in a motor vehicle accident. So again, just take a look at this article, and it reminds me that we need to look at things like our triage protocols. For the tip and trick of the week this week, we're going to be looking at the START triage system. This is the system that you're going to need to use in a major mass casualty incident. And remember that major mass casualty incident refers to the number of patients when compared to the amount of resources available. So if you have a minivan with a family of five overturn and you are the first unit on the scene, you are going to use START triage until you get enough resources to handle the number of patients you have. Now, of course, if there are minor injuries and there's only one seriously injured patient, you'll triage that appropriately and then deal with the seriously injured patient. But START triage is based upon not a certain number of patients. It is based upon the number of patients in a ratio compared to the amount of resources available. If you do not have enough providers to give at least one provider per patient attention, or quickly assess one or two patients and that's all you have, that is what START triage is there for. This program was developed in California and has spread across the country. There have been some updates. In the case of pediatric patients, there was a variation created called Jump Start, and this allowed for some additional steps to not so quickly call a child a deceased patient. And it provided for both allowing for child resiliency regarding serious injuries, as well as dealing with provider guilt over just rapidly passing over a dead child or a child that may be marked as deceased. It gave a few extra steps to allow for a provider to do a few extra quick assessments and interventions on a child to see if they were truly a deceased individual or a person beyond immediate care with the resources available. Some things about the philosophy of START. First of all, it is a system that is meant to use existing skills. This means that you know everything you need to know to operate this system if you are an EMS provider right now. A BLS or ALS provider possesses the necessary skills. In fact, all of the skills involved in START are BLS skills. These are your initial assessment skills, your CPR skills in many cases for some of the immediate patients. And so this is something that everybody can access and utilize. And it is something that you need to return to, refresh your memory on, and revisit frequently. Start triage is one of those things that is not used very frequently unless you make a point to use it very frequently. And like I said, you can use this with any number of patients. So if you get into the habit of when you have a situation where you have more than one patient, if you just think the steps of start triage as you approach the scene, you will be better prepared for that bus accident or that train crash or that plane wreck. You know, these things are all likely to happen to somebody. They may never happen to you, but if you are not prepared for them, you can quickly freeze up. You can make some bad decisions. This is something that can be practiced on every single patient assessment situation, just as far as keeping it in the back of your mind. When you walk up to a patient and you begin your initial assessment, think, where would this person fall on the start scale? Are they going to be marked immediate? Are they going to be marked delayed? Are they going to be marked minor? Or are they going to be marked deceased? If you have one patient, you may be able to perform additional interventions to take care of a patient who would be marked deceased in a start triage situation. But it's good to recognize that you would not be performing the steps of CPR on a patient in a triage situation with multiple casualties. Now, you may go around and reassess everybody and come back to that patient when you realize everyone else has minor injuries and doesn't require immediate interventions. And then that patient becomes your top priority. But until you've assessed a group of patients, you have to leave those patients that are requiring prolonged life-saving steps until you have assessed the entire scene. So let's take a look at some of the aspects of start triage. And then for Medicast Extra members, there'll be an extended version of this file that will go a little bit more in-depth into pediatric aspects of the Jumpstart program, the offshoot of this that deals with pediatric patients specifically. The goal of start triage is to require you to quickly assess a patient in less than 60 seconds for each patient. And that goal is focused on providing the most available resources for the patient that those resources can best be used for. In other words, if you have a large number of patients, we need to get the resources to those patients we can conceivably save in the short term until additional resources arrive, and not waste time and effort on a patient that will require extended resources when additional patients may be passing into that deceased category because you didn't provide immediate interventions that were needed for a patient that could have survived had you provided them. So let's start off with a look at how triage and start system is set up. You're going to quickly assess basically your initial assessment. You're going to be assessing ventilation, you're going to be assessing perfusion, and you're going to be assessing mental status. You start off by perhaps correcting severe correctable life threats such as blocked airways and slowing or stopping severe bleeding. You will use available resources that you have. In other words, you can hold pressure on a severe bleed, and if there's someone else there to assist with that, you can have a bystander press their heel of their hand against that gauze or that trauma pad and hold pressure while you move on to another patient. That may or may not save that patient, but it will do better than just you having to walk away because you have to continue your assessments. So correcting immediate life threats, and if that doesn't solve the problem, you move on. The other thing is that you will be looking at which patients can ambulate, which patients are breathing, have pulse, and are alert and oriented. You start off with the most easy aspect of this is when you arrive at a scene, you find out of you have a large number of patients, you quickly find out who can walk. Anybody that can get up and move on their own, please move over and stand by that tree or stand by the side of my ambulance on the sidewalk. And this situation allows you to at least allow for the people that are alert and oriented and able to follow commands. You are allowing for people that are able to move around. They do not have such serious injuries that they're unable to ambulate. And they may have a broken arm, they may have a bump to the head, cuts, bruises, and abrasions, but at least for the near term, they are alert and oriented. So even if they do have a suspected head injury, that head injury is not preventing them from following instructions and moving to where you need to follow. Again, you're not writing off these patients, you're not ignoring these patients, but in the near term, these patients do not need immediate life threat interventions. You next are going to be using some skills to check for basic perfusion, and this may be palpating for a radial pulse or checking for capillary refill. You also are going to be moving on to assessing all those patients that could not move on their own. You will make sure you direct those walking wounded, those patients that are minor or green patients, you're going to direct them to a safe area. So make sure you think about that as you approach. Where can I put my minor injuries? Where can I segregate them until additional resources arrive? You want them off the roadway, out of danger areas. Selecting a grassy area in shade will protect them from, you know, weather. If it's a very hot day, if it's a cooler day, you may want to select an area in sunshine to allow for some additional heat and not worry about having to deal with hypothermia down the road with these patients. Once you've directed these patients to go ahead and move to the safe area, watch them, keep an eye on them, and also look at the ones that seem to be best off. These may be the ones that you quickly bring over to assist you with something like applying pressure to a bleed. The next steps are pretty simple and straightforward. And they start off with your initial assessment skills that you already possess. You've already separated out the walking wounded. They're tagged as minor. You're now going to move in and start tagging the remainder of the patients. The minor patients are tagged green. You're now going to figure out which patients are either going to be black, deceased. They are going to be marked red, immediate, or marked yellow or amber if they are requiring or delayed, and that means that they may require immediate treatment at a later point. They are more seriously injured, but they are not currently immediately requiring treatment. You move on and you start checking your patients. The first thing you do is you assess their respiratory rate, their breathing. If they're not breathing, reposition the airway, open their airway using a head tilt chin lift, no jaw thrust, because remember, you'd have to sit there and maintain a jaw thrust. So you don't worry about head and spine injuries in this situation. You're going to position the upper airway and see if they begin breathing on their own. If they do not, they become marked deceased. If they are they breathing rapidly? In an adult, is their respiratory rate greater than 30? If it is, mark them as immediate. If it is less than 30, move on and quickly check their pulse. Can you palpate a radial pulse? Don't count it, just palpate it, and check capillary refill in the nail beds. Is the capillary refill greater than 2 seconds? If this is true, then they are marked as immediate. If capillary refill is less than 2 seconds and they have a palpable pulse, you're going to move on and check mental status. If they do not obey commands, they are marked as immediate. If they are able to obey your commands, they are marked delayed. So this system progresses through and you assess each patient in less than 60 seconds. That is your goal in this situation. So that's a look at the START triage program. And remember, Medicast Extra listeners, you'll be getting an extended version of this over at the Medicast Extra that includes a look at the pediatric jumpstart additions to this program. For the Med of the Week this week, we're going to be looking at morphine. Morphine is a narcotic analgesic, and while it may not be the only narcotic analgesic medication that you are allowed to give under your protocols, it is the most commonly used medication in that arena in the United States, and I think in many parts of the world. There are others that are out there, and we've addressed some of those in other episodes, and we'll address the others in future episodes as well. So let's take a look at morphine. Of course, there are links in the show notes to the Maryland Medical Protocols, which is what I use for my protocols, as well as a link to a WebMD article on the use of IV morphine. So those resources are there for you as well in the show notes for this episode. Of course, you need to follow your own protocols, so I will be giving dose ranges and different other information here. You need to follow the protocols as they relate to your particular practice. Morphine is a medication, a narcotic analgesic. Basically, that means it decreases the perception of pain and also has some effect on reducing anxiety. It also will, like many narcotics or opioid narcotics, will relax the respiratory drive and may decrease respirations significantly, and that is something you'll need to watch for. It also causes peripheral vasodilation and will decrease preload. This makes it useful as a medication to help out addressing pain in patients that are experiencing an MI. It also will decrease left ventricular afterload. Again, by dilating the peripheral vasculature, it reduces that pressure against which the left ventricle has to pump. So this makes it a useful medication in treating pain in cardiac patients, not just in treating pain in all the other patients. Of course, with patients that are in a multi-trauma situation and you're trying to deal with their pain, be prepared to have some Narcan or naloxone on hand. This medication can be used to help deal with a painful situation when you're extricating a patient, but you need to be prepared to deal with the drop in blood pressure that might occur, the decrease in respiratory drive that might occur, especially in a patient that is already perhaps experiencing some internal bleeding. You'll have to use this with caution, and your protocols may require you to seek medical consult for anything but peripheral painful injuries. The morphine sulfate binds with opiate receptors in the central nervous system, and this alters both the perception and the response to pain. It is onset of actions about 5 minutes or less in an IV dose, and it lasts about 4 to 5 hours. Now, that's its total lasting effect. You will find that patients that have more significant pain will be able to take more morphine to deal with that pain than somebody with a lesser level of pain. For instance, a burn patient, you will use up the morphine on your ambulance on a prolonged transport, trying to get a hold of just the edge of the pain in a burn patient. And this is that sign that, you know, these opioid receptors use up that medication very quickly and are ready to bind more. And so these pain receptors continually fire, and more pain equals the need for a greater dose. The problem that you need to watch for very carefully is that it will cause peripheral arterial and venous vasodilation. So be aware that you're going to see a drop in blood pressure. If you have a patient that's on the edge of a decent blood pressure, you're going to want to use a lesser dose or very carefully be prepared to monitor that patient and be prepared to administer naloxone as the antidote to remove the effects very quickly. You may also want to be prepared. Of course, you're giving this IV, so you're going to have an IV set up and ready to go, but you're going to want to be prepared to administer a fluid bolus perhaps as well to maintain blood pressure. The indications for the use of this drug, we've already talked about it a little bit. Of course, acute myocardial infarction because of the positive cardiac side effects when you're trying to reduce preload and reduce the afterload effects on the heart. It can have some effects on preload, so you want to be aware of, if you can, a 12-lead and looking at where the MI is occurring. Anything that's affecting the right side of the heart, is if you reduce preload, you're going to reduce the effectiveness of the right side, and you're going to start seeing problems accompanying a right-sided cardiac event. Also indicated for pain involving injuries such as burns. And also, perhaps you'd be using this medication associated with isolated injuries requiring pain relief or as a sedative. Again, remember, it has some anxiety-reducing effects in patients that you are providing transcutaneous pacing. So this is one of those meds along with your benzodiazepines, your medications like Valium, you're going to want to use this medication as an alternative to try to reduce anxiety in patients that are being paced. Contraindications under my protocols, and I suspect under many protocols, presence of head injury, multi-system trauma, patients with COPD and having a compromised respiratory effort, patients with ongoing hypotension, and patients who have any sensitivity to morphine, Percodan or codeine. So you want to ask them if they've had pain medications before. They may not remember the names of those pain medications, but ask them if they've had an adverse effect to the medication. You may want to hold off on administering morphine if they have previously had an adverse response to any analgesic pain medication if the patient can't readily identify the name of that medication. Some adverse effects, we've talked about these as well. You are going to want to watch the patient carefully for signs of respiratory depression or arrest, signs of altered mental status, decreased level of consciousness, maybe signs of the patient having an onset of reduced respiratory drive or a decreased blood pressure to the point that they are not perfusing adequately. Also, you want to watch for increased vagal tone. This is because this medication affects the sympathetic pathways, and it may slow your heart rate as well. They are also at an increased risk for nausea and vomiting. Some people have that effect to narcotic and opioid medications, so you need to be prepared to protect the airway and suction. And you also need to watch for other signs and effects that you might expect from an opioid dosing, including constricted pupils, and it will also increase cerebral blood flow. So this may cause them to have a headache because they're going to have a little bit more pressure in the head. And this is why if you have a head injury, you don't want to give this medication. We don't want to increase blood flow to the brain in the cases of a closed head injury because that will increase intracranial pressure. Precautions you're going to need to want to have on hand for morphine. Remember that you need to have some Narcan out. You may not need to draw any up right away, but you do need to have it available. Perhaps have a syringe ready to draw up so that you can quickly administer a dose of Narcan as needed. This will reverse all negative side effects. The administration of this drug will mask pain. So if you are dealing with a patient where you suspect they are having injuries or other problems, this may mask your further assessment. So you're going to want to make sure you've done a very thorough assessment before you go ahead and administer this medication because it may mask additional reassessment. Also, this should be administered slowly. And even though you may draw up a certain dose, as you administer it, you may find that the desired effect has occurred with a lesser dose than you anticipated. So administering this medication, slow IV push, and then titrating the dose to the effect desired. And you're not going to remove their pain entirely. We're not going to be snowing them completely in the field. We are going to be taking the edge off their pain. So we want to see them, if they have a pain level of 8, 9, or 10, we'd like to see that come down to maybe 5, 6, or 7, and maybe even a little bit lower than that. But we are not going to remove their pain, and they need to understand that. It's where you talk to the patient and go, I can give you something to take the edge off, but it is not going to get rid of your pain entirely. Monitor vital signs frequently. You're looking for drops in blood pressure, decreased heart rate, and decreased respirations or absent respirations. So you want to be reassessing these patients. And you want to make sure you understand that any patient with a suspected bleed or has already become volume depleted, either because they're dehydrated or because they have an injury, these patients are going to be at greater risk for the onset of hypotension. The dose, under my protocols at least, may range in your protocols anywhere from 2 to 10 milligrams per dose. In my protocol, we're looking at 2 to 5 milligrams slow IV push for patients with acute myocardial infarction, and additional doses of 1 milligram every 5 minutes to a maximum of 10 or until the pain is relieved. And this is for, again, chest pain associated with AMI. This is going to be also available for isolated injuries, including burns, frostbite, trauma to the eye, 2 to 10 milligrams, slow IV push, 1 to 2 milligrams per minute. That's what slow IV push is meaning here, up to 10 milligrams or until the pain is relieved. Also, for doses above 10 milligrams in Maryland, at least, we need to get additional consultation. And of course, for administration for AMI in Maryland, you will need additional consultation for this dose as well. You may also administer this medication IM 5 to 15 milligrams based on patient weight if there is no IV access available. Again, medical consult required. And if you're pacing the patient and you're trying to alleviate the anxiety and pain associated with transcutaneous pacing. You can administer 1 to 2 milligrams per minute IV push in the effort to remove this anxiety response. Pediatric dosing is 0.1 milligrams per kilogram IV push, IO or IM. 1 to 2 milligrams per minute is your slow IV push rate. And the maximum dose for pediatric patients is 5 milligrams. So that's a look at morphine and some of the side effects. And again, the dosing is the Maryland Medical Protocol dosing. You need to refer to your own protocols for your dosing requirements and medical consult requirements. But that's a brief look at the drug morphine. That's going to wrap up this episode of the Medicast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and remind you all to head over to medicast.com/blog. That'll take you to the Medicast blog and the show notes page. If you just go to medicast.com, you'll actually get to the Medicast network page, and you can click the link there to get into the Medicast blog as well. Once at the Medicast blog, you'll be able to check the show notes and links for this episode and be able to follow up on all of the information presented here. If you'd like to get back in touch with me with some comments, suggestions for this or future episodes, if you'd like to offer corrections to something, maybe I misspoke, you can do all of that by sending me an email to podmedic@mac.com. And you can also reach me on the Medicast voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. We love to hear from people on the voicemail line. If you do call the voicemail line, make sure you wait at the very end and give me your email address. If I need to get back in touch with you, I can do so using your email and quickly follow up if I need some expansion on your question, be able to better answer your question that way. Don't worry, I'll cut your email address off when I play your voicemail comment on the air. Another excellent way to participate in the Medicast community is to join the Medicast forums. It's free to join the forums, and it's a great way for you to get questions answered maybe a little quickly than I could answer them, basically because the entire community participates there. So become a member of that community, get your questions answered, and look around and answer and offer suggestions and comments to other people's posts. You can also upload photographs and videos there, and it's a great way to become a more involved member of the Medicast community. I'll close out with PodSafe music, just like I always do. This week, again, from the PodSafe Music Network. This is a new artist here to the Medicast Network, an artist by the name of Curtis Peoples, and this is his song, Back Where I Started. If you like what you hear, head over to Curtis's site link in the show notes and let him know you heard it here on the Medicast. Of course, you can find links to most of the songs played here in the Medicast Network on each show notes page, and you can actually purchase those songs in many instances using the button to click and send you over to iTunes. So you can use that resource as well. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I want to remind all of you to come back and check out next week's episode and to remember to stay safe. And remember, scene safety, BSI. Take care.
Won't save you at all. Your cheating has broke us apart. Fooled around on me this time. Fooled around for the last time. Baby, now I'm back where I started. This lonely dance of a broken heart. Well, I'm done with you breaking my heart.